Support for WYPR comes from University of Maryland Medical System, committed to advancing the health of Maryland through academic medicine. With locations across the state, care is delivered close to home. Learn more at ummms.org.
Dying at 66 was pretty bad. But also, her dying at 66, I think, is one of the most selfless things she's ever done.
First, I need to tell you that I do not believe in ghosts. But I also don't not believe in ghosts.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Stoop Storytelling Series podcast. I'm Laura Wexler.
And I'm Jessica Hankin.
This week on the podcast, The Thin Place, two stories about people who may have been visited by loving spirits.
And we mean like the veil is thin.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. Yeah. No, not dimensionally.
Not dimensionally.
Yeah.
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 So this first story is from Josh Riley, who is an old dear friend and is just one of those people who is so naturally funny and charming.
He is a raconteur. Yes.
Charismatic. And he shared this story last October, but it could be heard all year round. So take a listen.
So it's the summer of 2013, and I'm driving up the BW Parkway. Well, I'm speeding up the BW Parkway, and I'm listening to the hot dance banger, I Love It, by the Swedish synth pop duo Icona Pop. You know the song whether you know it or not. I got this feeling on a summer day when you were gone. I crashed my car into the bridge. I watched, I let it burn. I threw your into a bag and kicked it down the stairs. I crashed my car into the bridge. I don't care. I love it. Etc. I'm not going to sing you the whole song. That would be truly scary. But I'm listening to this song. I'm not just listening to this song. I'm listening to this song over and over and over. And I've put it on repeat for the entire duration of the drive, there and back. And I'm making this drive all the time because it has become the perfect ritual, and I don't know why, for my trip to the BW Medical Center to have a death vigil with my mother, who was finally dying of alcoholism in the hospital. And it was a strange choice of song, perhaps, but it has this great mixture of sort of like defiance and anger and pain and sadness, but also joy and happiness and kind of F you. And I went on to read in the Icona Pop Wikipedia article that they like to make music that you can laugh or cry to. So, check. The first time I got to the hospital and visited her, she was intubated and sedated and lying there with a really intense clonazepam drip that was trying to stave off her incredible withdrawal symptoms. And so she's got the DTs, and her feet were kind of pumping in this rhythmic way that almost looked like they were moving to a beat. Dying at 66 was pretty bad. But also, her dying at 66, I think, is one of the most selfless things she's ever done. And I say selfless that she's done because she always kind of thought that she had control over that sort of thing, and we used to talk about it when I was little. I would visit her on the weekends. I was maybe 12 years old, and we would hang out, and she was the cool mom, right, because Dad had custody. So we would talk about the occult and spirituality and UFOs and ghosts. And she would tell me all these incredible stories, ghost stories and other stuff that had happened to her. And so we made a pact. And I was like, when you die, she was so laissez-faire about it. And she said, you know, if I end up disabled or miserable or whatever, I'm going to make some hemlock tea and just take myself out, you know. She was a white lady from Indiana, but she had a very Latinx kind of perspective on death. Like, if it's your time, it's your time, and bring snacks, you know. So we're talking about it, and I said, look, if you have the ability when you die to come back and, like, pop in on me, like, I want you to, some kind of sign, not like lipstick on the mirror or like a doll baby rocking in a, none of that. I don't want any of that. But if you can come back, come back. And My sister had long ago forsaken her relationship with my very complicated alcoholic mother and was quite satisfied with that. But I had stuck with it, you know, despite the narcissism and the self-absorption and the... It does make for good stories. But nonetheless, you know, I had kind of stuck it out, even though it was pretty painful. So here I am on my way, in and off, back and forth from the BW Medical Center, visiting her and sort of thinking about all of this. And I had hoped that maybe there would be a few good times left still as well. And we almost had one. When I got there one time, about a month into her, it was a 3 month, but about a month in, she'd rallied, she was doing pretty well, and she'd called me and said, "Honey, the food here is really bad. And do you remember how we used to make ice cream in the summertime in that cool sort of like barrel-y looking ice cream maker with the big heavy motor on top? And we would pick strawberries from the garden and then I'd sugar them and we'd put them on top of the ice cream. Do you remember that?" "Yeah, Mom. Yeah, I remember that. I totally remember that. It was awesome." And she said, "Well, you know, will you bring me some? Because the food here is pretty bad." And I was like, "Oh my God, of course, you know, she had me, what a memory." So I went home from work and I got the strawberries and I sugared them and I put them in a container, and about 13 or 14 I love it's later, I was in the hospital with her, presenting her with the strawberries. And she had a bite or two and she was like, "I'm really tired, I think I'm gonna nap a little bit." And I just sat there with her and enjoyed being there with her even though she wasn't awake. And two visits later, a nurse pulled me aside and said, "You know, your mother hid that under her bed and let it ferment, right?" And I think that she'd managed to get down some of her, like, bedpan jailhouse hooch before they took it away from her. But, you know, respect, honestly, you know? Like, I get it. I get it. I get how you want to go until the wheels fall off. And she manipulated me pretty well. I mean, I had always been one of her chief enablers. She had trained that. I mean, it was a thing. So about a month later, the wheels really started to fall off. And it was the end of July. My sister had come to be with me, not with her, to be with me from North Carolina. And by this point, they had moved my mother to the death floor of the hospital, which really didn't have a lot of staff. There was almost nothing going on. It was just a bunch of rooms kind of in a square that opened into like a central lounge, kind of like a death barn. I don't know. They were sort of like stalls. And so my sister stayed out there. My sister did not go and lay eyes on my mother until after she died. And when she did, it was just to walk in, stand like this in the doorway and go boom, boom, to make sure she was dead, and walked off. But I stuck it out, like I always had. So I'm giving my sister like real-time updates on my phone as my mother's like dying actively in the room. Nobody else is around. It must have been a light day on the death floor because there was virtually no one. And I would go out and talk to my sister and go back in or whatever. Mom dies. And this is sort of not related to the story, but I had this incredible, overwhelming thought, which was, well, that didn't look so hard. I can probably do that when the time comes. And I'm really grateful for her for that. But I leave the room. We're standing out in the death lounge. The doctor's there, and my mother's maybe fifth husband or something is there, and my sister. And we're just talking through all the details about what happens next or whatever, when all of a sudden, "I got this feeling on a summer day when you were gone. I crashed my car into the bridge. Came blasting out of one of the other death rooms. And I mean blasting, like Baltimore City streets, 1980s ghetto blaster, blasting out of this room. And I thought maybe I was in some sort of like grief, fugue, state, dissociative something. So I grabbed my sister's hand and I said, "Did you hear that? Was that real?" I had not told a soul about my weird ritual with the song up and down, right? Not a soul. No one knew about it. My sister looks at me like, "Yeah, girl, I heard that. Everyone heard that." And I was like, wow, okay. So I told her about it later, and we both just laughed because that was kind of our mother. She had the last word, and she got to do it on her own terms. Thanks.
I love that song, by the way. I mean, I love the way that Josh tells the story, and I love Josh, and I love everything about that story, but also I love that song. That mm-hmm. song pumps me up. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's great. Mm-hmm. And clearly, his mom really appreciated that he loved it and wanted to give him that gift.
Okay, we'll take a minute and come back with another story. So this next story is from Julie Sharper, who is a longtime reporter and feature writer in Baltimore. Take a listen.
First, I need to tell you that I do not believe in ghosts. But I also don't not believe in ghosts. And there are certain times, like late October, in places like this, where it feels like the veil is thinner. Sorry. Hello. And I think that perhaps this is the kind of place where there could be ghosts, and in which case I'd like to say thank you for having us here tonight and listening to all these stories. I feel like there might be ghosts like that belong to places or buildings, or like there might be like loving spirits that like follow along on people's shoulders. I was raised Catholic, but like the Catholic that's like very open-minded about all the like woo-woo kind of things. And we're Lithuanian, and my mother always said that that was a Lithuanian thing, that Lithuania was one of the last countries to accept Christianity in its region of the world. So anyway, that's why I was not that surprised to see my grandmother's ghost in front of a retail establishment that you might be familiar with. It is called Ross Dress for Less. And this was the summer after my freshman year of college. I was going to get a bathing suit for a date that involved hiking along Rock State Park. And there she was in her tan trench coat, looking very sharp on the sidewalk. She had a jaunty little hat on, like she always did. And she motioned me over to a bench. You should know that my grandmother, besides being very fashionable, she had a quick temper. So I did not mention to her the fact that she was dead and she had been dead for a year and a half, because she was very real on the sidewalk in front of Ross Dress for Less. And she loved a bargain. She loved a bargain. She grew up quite poor in the area of Southwest Baltimore that was where all the Lithuanian immigrants lived in this time period. If you've been to Lithuanian Hall, that was the hub of her community, and those kind of like shining style photos of banquets in the 40s, like that's all my aunts and uncles and my people in there. Her mother had a speakeasy on Lombard Street, and which was kind of pin money. My grandmother's stepfather had a tailor shop, and that was kind of how they paid the bills, and everything was rough. There was some, it was just really tough. And I looked up their names in the Baltimore Sun archive and like, ooh, they did some stuff. But anyway, I found this out after I named my, anyway, I won't explain that. My grandmother had to drop out of school after fifth grade to work in the tailor shop, and she made buttons. That was her first job. So she used a press to punch buttons out of oyster shells. Eventually, she became an amazing seamstress. She could sew absolutely anything. And she was self-educated. She read all the time. She read everything. She knew all about the news. She could beat anyone in Scrabble. She could beat anyone in cards. We played a lot of Canasta together. That's such a good game. And there she was, and I was sitting with her on this bench. I could sense her in a way that I had not physically experienced her since she had died. It was like some librarian in the back recesses of my brain had like opened up a jar of memories of her, and I could see she had these like really bright ice blue eyes. I could see her eyes again. She had a little divot in the tip of her nose, very unique, and I hadn't thought about it since she died, and I saw it again. She was so physically real to me, and yet I was completely aware that others outside walking by Ross Dress for Less would not see her. And so I could smell her. She had this smell like dusting powder and Jean Nate and the instant coffee, I forgot what the brand was, and just her, the grandmom, like hug, love, loving smell. Like I could smell her again. And so I sat on the bench, and I just told her about my life and everything that had changed in my life in the 18 months since she had died. I had graduated from high school, from Notre Dame prep, and taken off my blue dress with the little bow and saddle shoes, and like I was in college, I was at Hopkins, I had pierced my nose and cut my hair off, and I was wearing giant cargo pants. And I had a lot of stuff to tell her. I was like really becoming myself and really forging my identity. And I had recently come out to my family as bi, and I felt weird that I hadn't told her. I felt like I had retroactively lied to her or something. Like I just had this like unfinished sense. So I told her everything, and she was really proud of me, and she said she really loved me. And she asked me all about my mom, her daughter, and my sister, who she'd been really close to. And I felt just so like, holy shit, my life has changed, because now I'm always going to get to hang out with grandmom's ghost, and she just lives with me in my pocketbook or something, and this is great. But she said, take care of your mom, take care of your sister. And she patted me on the knee, which is a thing she always did, and she said, let's go shopping. And she stood up, and she took her cane, and she just walked away, and she was just gone. Like, the little trench coat and the jaunty hat and the brooch and the powdery scent, like, just gone. And I don't believe in ghosts, right? And I was a psychology major, so I was like, this is something that my brain just invented to give me a sense of closure, and that's really cool. And like hell yeah, the human brain does amazing stuff. And I was like, so I should be able to bring her back if I created her. And I tried to, and she was just gone. Like, that was it. So I still had to buy a bathing suit. So I went into Ross, and I looked around, and I found a really cute like bikini. It was blue. It had flowers. It looked so good, and it was on clearance. so I I never know what to make of that story. Like, was that my grandmother's ghost? Is that what a ghost is? Like, that, if there's gonna be ghosts, I feel like it might be like that. Or was it something that my brain invented? And, like, that would really be useful for us as a species if our brain could invent useful narratives sometimes to give us emotional closure. So that is a possibility. But I will say that for, like, this bikini lasted me a couple years, and it was great, and we did so much stuff together. And when I would wear it and people would say, oh, I really like your bikini, I would be like, thanks, my grandmom helped me pick it out at Ross Dress for Less.
Grandmother loved a bargain. Yeah. Ross Dress for Less. I mean where it's
so good. It's so utterly unbelievable and absolutely believable at the same time.
Yeah.
It's great.
I feel like if my mother were going to come back as a ghost, she would be like trying to get me to remember,
Laura,
my coupons.
Don't forget that you need a quarter for the card
Aldi.
At Aldi. Laura.
I got this on sale. I have coupons for Burger King.
Laura, look, there's a sale rack at Aldi.
Okay, God bless her. Thanks for joining us today for our stories about folks being visited by loving spirits. You can visit us at stoopstorytelling.com. You can find out about shows and listen to stories. We want to thank Maureen Harvey for producing the show. We'll be back soon with more stories from The Stoop.